Welcome to episode 14 of Open Source Underdogs, the podcast where the founders of open source software companies tell us how they achieved escape velocity. As the Glue World Tour extended into month four, we visited Cape Town, South Africa, and we're honored to get a chance to interview Mark Shuttleworth, founder and CEO of Canonical. In the 90s, Mark founded Thought, a certification authority subsequently acquired by VeriSign for around $500 million. Not content to sit on a beach, Mark then pursued one of his lifelong dreams, space. After training for a year, he became the world's second self-funded space tourist and the first South African in space, blasting off on the Russian Soyuz TM-34 space mission. But perhaps his most enduring contribution was still yet to come. Mark embarked on a mission to bring Ubuntu Linux to the world. Canonical is the business behind Ubuntu. Canonical is a fascinating business. It's forged a powerful business model. For a large business, it's surprisingly exploitation-free. Without outside investors pushing him for short-term gains, Mark has the freedom to pursue a truly long-term strategy. Although how Canonical got started probably can't be replicated, Mark has some deep insights into the open source ecosystem. And just like any business advice, take it with a grain of salt, but some of it you can hopefully repurpose for your challenges. So enough of my blabbering, let's cut to the tape. Mark, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, that's a pleasure.
My first question is a space question. Did your experience preparing for and undertaking a space mission change your approach to entrepreneurship?
I guess I'd put it the other way around. I think my experience with entrepreneurship before going to space shaped the way I put together a space mission. There were a lot of entrepreneurial elements to the way we put that project together. And being a lot younger than the typical astronaut, cosmonaut, coming from a commercial background, having had to sort of drive a small business, it was a lot of those skills mapped into negotiating with the various agencies and groups that were responsible for Russian space flight, telling the story, what we were trying to do, building a community around the mission, and then sort of making all of the pieces sort of work out, managing, operating, controlling all of that. So I guess it really was a personal project that benefited from an entrepreneurial perspective effectively in an industry which is the sort of exact opposite of entrepreneurship.
We could probably spend the next half an hour just asking you questions about space, but this is a podcast about business.
I'm pretty sure many of us will get there. We're at the dawn of a much more transparent access to space. Pretty certain that the experiences that I had, in some senses, hundreds of thousands of people have similar experiences or the opportunity to participate in some way with our next big steps as a species.
That would be amazing. I hope you're right. But switching tracks to business and Canonical, why'd you start Canonical?
Before I went to space, I built a business in the field of security and cryptography and commerce, online commerce. I had the great benefit of being able to pull together open source components to support and underpin that operation. And it struck me that this is a great way to accelerate innovation, that the generosity of others was enabling me to go faster as an innovator and as an entrepreneur. So I was in the fortunate position I could sit back and think about what kind of impact I wanted to have in the world. And it struck me that that would be a great way to return the favor, to simplify and reduce the cost of integrating open source would allow lots of other people who are willing to take risks and had ideas to move the ball forward faster than it would if it was just in the hands of a few large organizations. As technology, you know, that pendulum always swings, and back in the 90s, technology was very much in the hands of a very few large organizations. I want to be part of breaking that open and enabling open source to be part of breaking that open. There's lots of different ways to do that. You can go chase a particular idea as open source, or you can look at the open source experience from end to end and think about how to make that better for the people who are innovating and the people who are consuming and building on it, and to structure the relationship between them so that it's healthy and easier.
Canonical was your second business, and one of the challenges around starting your second business is figuring out which lessons from the first business you don't apply to the second business.
You know, they're so extremely different that I really didn't think that just because I'd been fortunate in one case that I could count on the same good fortune in other cases, or that certain instincts which worked in the one case would necessarily apply in the other case. When you do something completely different, it's the height of folly to think that it's, you know, something intrinsic in you. You really have to study the problem. And the sort of open source platform challenge is just completely different to many of the other sorts of opportunities in business or even in open source. So I still spend a lot of time thinking about the deep zen of what's going on, which often isn't the stuff that's stressing people out or the stuff that's in the headlines. Those are sort of contextual reactions to something that someone did. Most people tend to interpret what they see through the lens of the past. I try to think about what it might be like if we weren't concerned with the past. And so that's the approach that I brought to the platform, to Ubuntu, to Canonical.
So you're executive chairman of Canonical, not CEO. What does that mean exactly?
Well, what it means is that I'm really crap at updating my title on LinkedIn. I am CEO of Canonical and have been for a while. I spent some time as executive chairman, but I just haven't updated the.
I did see a press release about, or some news about how you're. I think the Wikipedia still says that you're not.
Well, I'm equally sort of not interested in updating my own Wikipedia.
But Wikipedia said it. It must be right.
Must be true. Yeah. No. Well, at one stage, I thought that the business needed a different focus from the CEO. And so I was lucky enough to have Jane Silber in the business, and she took on that responsibility for a good stretch, 7 years, which allowed me to focus more on things that were interesting to me and kind of foundational for what we're doing now. Today, I'm sort of more in a position of pulling all those threads together as CEO, and I guess I've enjoyed that return.
Everyone in the open source community is trying to make sense of the IBM acquisition of Red Hat. Canonical has had a great relationship with IBM. Were you surprised by the acquisition announcement, and what do you think it means for the community?
I thought it was pretty clear for a long time that Red Hat wanted to find a buyer. There was signals of that sort of preferred outcome, so I wasn't surprised that in the end there was a transaction. I was very surprised that one division in IBM was able to engineer such a large amount of debt for the whole business to take Red Hat on. So, you know, in a sense, it's a great deal for Red Hat shoulders, investors, owners. It's a great deal for the bankers if it works out. And it remains to be seen if it's a great deal for IBM. But I buy the thesis that in a cloud world, the ability to work well on the public cloud and on your private infrastructure is important. And RHEL is an important part of most enterprises' private infrastructure. So the thesis of combining IBM's public infrastructure with the RHEL approach to private infrastructure, I think, is a reasonable thesis. We'll have to see what the execution around that looks like. And the end of the day, because of the economics of the deal, there's an enormous amount of money that has to be brought in by IBM through the deal to justify the purchase price. And I'm pretty sure customers are going to end up being faced with that price. That creates an opportunity for us. My thinking, again, right from the beginning with Ubuntu, with Canonical, was that I wanted to be sure that I drove the friction and the cost of building on open source, consuming open source, down. Even in the late 90s, early 2000s, I felt that it was really important for the true benefits of open source to come to the widest possible audience, that there were people in the ecosystem working on driving that cost down rather than essentially working on various short-term monopolies or other sort of positions of power that might bubble up in open source in order to sort of behave like, you know, the old school power players of the tech 90s. So we're very committed to driving down the cost of infrastructure that's open source, driving down the cost of operating that infrastructure. That, I think, puts us in stark contrast with where Red Hat was, and increasingly where I think IBM will have to take Red Hat, because they're going to have to earn the money back to pay for the premium that they've put on top of Red Hat's already high valuation. So I think that bodes well. We've already seen some indication of that.
An operating system is a core infrastructure. Everyone could be your customer. How do you segment the market from a commercial perspective?
Internally within the organization, we think about places where people are working in aggregate. So cloud type infrastructure, where you're really blurring the lines between a single host, a single piece of infrastructure and the whole, and places out at the edge where essentially everything's a single point of failure. The operating regimes of those are quite different. The kinds of things that people are trying to do in those places are quite different. They echo off each other, but they are quite different. And the economics of those places are quite different. So if there is a primary segmentation, it's along those lines, right? The economics of cloud need to be shaped in a way that makes sense for cloud. The economics of appliances and devices need to be shaped in a way that makes sense for appliance and devices. If you zoom out, you can see a lot of common themes in both of those places. We're thinking about how to help people put the right software in the right place with the right version at the right time. But the mechanisms and the economics of both of those are completely different, and reality has to line up with that.
So when your market is everybody, who do you sell to? Like, how do you actually figure out where's the next deal going to come from?
Well, open source serves well to build a base of people who understand what they're going to get when they work with you. In our case, that's sometimes a little less obvious because people's relationship with the operating system is a little indirect, right? They're focused on an application, they're focused on a project, they're focused on a workload. It really only comes clear when they have been working with infrastructure or operating systems for a very, very long time, because then with the benefit of scale and time, you find yourself dealing with institutional type problems. What are all the different versions of Ubuntu out there? How do I understand whether or not they're compliant, whether or not they're secure? How do I manage them at scale? How do I keep them compliant? Those are not the sorts of questions that people are asking on day one. Those are not the sort of questions that individual teams will ask. It's only the sort of question, that sort of question gets asked only once you've been consumed at some scale across an entire organization. But Ubuntu very much is in that position today. And so we're usually able to find in almost any large organization that there is a substantial amount of usage of Ubuntu, and then show the organization how their relationship with that platform gets better in working with Canonical.
And that leads into my next question, which is DMB was showing around $130 million in revenue for, I think it was the year ended 2017. I'm sure you're doing more now. Can you shed some light on the breakdown of revenue? Is it mostly license? Is it subscription? And there's Canonical has a whole range of services and products. Like, is there an 80-20 rule where 80% of the revenue is coming from 20% of the products?
Look, we do a mix of things, and that's deliberate. You know, we're quite willing to do non-recurring engagements because in many cases, we can help people, whether they are, for example, startups or entrepreneurs making an IoT device or businesses building clouds and so on, we can accelerate their path to productivity because we have a whole pile of knowledge and, you know, that we can call on that they don't have. It'd be much more expensive and take a lot longer and be a lot less predictable if every one of those businesses needed to kind of do that bootstrapping work for themselves. So we're quite happy to dig in and do work that people would typically think of as kind of consulting type engagements. I know that that's not considered sexy in Silicon Valley, but it's an enormous benefit to customers who otherwise effectively have to figure out how to staff something that they don't understand. The way we frame that is that our job is to get the business into a position where it's very clear how they continue to operate efficiently. In many cases, that means doing a bunch of sort of heavy lift up front with that business, which is not a subscription, not a service, not licensing, you know, none of the typical things that Silicon Valley likes. However, if I come back to the original point, our core goal is to drive down the cost of consuming open source. And the only way we can do that is if we share that cost across many, many players. And so subscription and licensing type products really achieve that. In the end, we make a much more cost-effective platform by sharing the cost of all of the things that people end up caring about it. They may not really understand that when they start, but they end up caring a lot about those big picture things over time. And by licensing the product, licensing and running services that are recurring revenue services, we're really essentially reducing the cost to everybody of those critical functions.
What would you say is the core value proposition of Ubuntu or of Canonical's commercial offering?
Managing open source, engaging with open source at scale. You know, if you look at the generations of open source, in the first generation, you know, you had open source components. You had a great compiler that a small community was building on that was interesting. You had tools, a fork here, a spoon there, a knife there, right? You didn't really have a hole. And so companies like Cygnus that were closely involved in those individual tools, those were the sort of poster children, the figureheads for open source. Then with the emergence of Linux, it sort of moved up a layer, and we got the idea of a sort of a base operating system. People thought of a company like Red Hat as providing an alternative to something like Windows. Today, I think we're in a very different world. Today, if I look at GitHub, you can't really explain GitHub and what's available to a business on GitHub through the lens of anything that you've ever seen from the Oracles and IBMs of the world. You just can't. There's no analog. There's an analog for RHEL, right? It's Windows or it's Solaris. But there's no analog for the real benefits of embracing open source as a sort of an open source first type policy. And if I look at our customers, they tend to be companies that have moved fastest to say, I want the real open source. I want the real benefits of open source in my business. I want those everywhere in my business. The first waves, they needed to be closely associated with the business, right? People wanted to look at open source and make it feel like it came in a shrink wrap box from a company that they could relate to the way they related to Microsoft or to Sun or to Oracle. They wanted, obviously, a stronger sense of control in the relationship, and they wanted better economics, but fundamentally they still wanted that idea of a product from a company. You don't get that if you say, I'm opening my business up to GitHub, right? Well, you have to be willing to figure out how to be productive in a world where you say, I'm opening my business up to GitHub. That's the kind of relationship we end up having with organizations. Working with us, they're able to say, okay, yes, we're now consuming Linux at bigger scale, more cost effectively than we were when we were working with Red Hat. But more importantly, we're now actually accelerating our entire development and applications operation because we're opening ourselves up to GitHub, and the way Canonical works with us, that is tenable, that we understand how we can make that work. That's what I'm excited to do. It means that people who do put time and effort into things on GitHub can find a way either to get more users of that or to get a better return on that, depending on their particular interests.
Open source companies have a strange relationship with sales and marketing. Customers normally start using the software, and then they contact the vendor, as you mentioned, when they get to a certain scale. But can you talk about Canonical's approach to sales and marketing and how it evolved over the years?
The key thing for me is to view enterprises, customers, not as single things, because they aren't, right? An organization is a complex thing made up of lots of different functions and opinions and teams and so on. To move stuff forward, there needs to be some sort of consensus, especially at a platform type level. There needs to be some sort of consensus across that diversity that you're moving in the right direction. And so to my mind, it's important to be having simultaneously multiple different relationships and conversations with people in an organization that is a prospect or a customer. There are some of those relationships that are best done completely transparently as engineer to engineer, open source, code first, contribution matters type engagements. And we're quite unusual in encouraging our core engineers to speak with customers and encouraging our customers to speak with core engineers, because it strengthens that kind of communication. But it's also important to be able to sit down with other people in that organization and have conversations that make sense to them about things that they care about. I think the challenge comes if you cross those wires, right? If you think that you're going to run a marketing campaign to target developers, then you may be running the risk of, you know, using the wrong language, prioritizing the wrong things, emphasizing the wrong stuff. To my mind, developers love Canonical and Ubuntu because we're pretty focused on finding ways to help developers be more productive, go faster, experience less frustration and friction when they're dealing with that vast open-ended fire hose of open source. There are a different set of concerns that we have to deal with when we engage with the rest of a business. And so to the extent that we invest in sales and marketing, we certainly do, it's to make that more rounded communication possible. And I think it is important for every open source entrepreneur to understand that they need to be able to speak in multiple languages. It's the same message, but it's essentially framed in different languages to different parts of an enterprise.
Canonical has a deep technology partner network. It seems like everyone wants to partner with the makers of Ubuntu. How do you prioritize in which partnerships to invest?
I think this is actually one of the areas where I made a lot of mistakes early on, because as you say, there's an enormous number of companies that intersect with Ubuntu in one way or the other, and they do often want to engage, you know, talk about a partnership of one form or another. And I found that we were wasting a lot of resources in trying to conduct too many of those conversations at the same time, when in fact, the best thing we could do for many of those businesses was to enable them to go faster with Ubuntu, and they didn't need to be talking to us to do that. So the easiest way to kind of resolve that is to set a threshold of value, mutual value, on any potential relationship. And so we've done that essentially. If there isn't a clear path to a certain threshold of revenue to Canonical from a partnership, then there isn't a basis for investing in the conversation. There's almost certainly sort of appetite for a conversation because they're using Ubuntu. But when you sort of really dig into it, if neither side can see a clear path to a certain threshold of business they're going to do together, then you're better off, you know, letting your engineers correspond through the bug tracker. And so today, I think we have a much clearer view on the relationships that we're interested in. It's because we're a platform and we get used in so many different places in so many ways, I can't say that there's a particular game plan or strategy to that. There's simply the idea that very early in the conversation, we'll say, well, what's the path to doing a certain amount of business together? And if there's no clear answer to that, then the way forward is pretty clear. It's open source. You know how to use it. You're here because that's true. But if neither of us can see a clear way to grow faster together, then let's leave it, you know, as it is.
What have been some of the most successful partnerships so far?
The best partnerships come where people need a platform because they're doing something other than a platform. So an example of that would be somebody who's shipping appliances. They're selling something that does something very specific. People are looking for that function. They need an operating system. And we are the preferred operating system if their engineers have a say. And increasingly, engineers do have a say, right? Businesses know that to succeed, they need to go fast. To go fast, they need their engineers to be happy and productive. So since we focus a lot on keeping the engineers happy and productive, we're typically the preferred platform for people in that sort of space. And again, we're pretty focused on driving down the cost of the platform, making it cost effective for people to build services on top of Ubuntu, ship them, be able to answer all the type platform questions that people have. Is it certified on this hardware? Where can I get support? How long will I get support? Is it certified for these purposes? It's certified in these countries. Who's going to handle this kind of call? Who's going to handle that kind of call? What do we do in these circumstances? You know, that's a lot more complexity than most businesses want to deal with internally when it isn't their business effectively. So our best partnerships come where people are very clear in their minds that they need a platform, also clear in their minds that that's not their primary business. A secondary kind of layer would be places where people understand that Ubuntu is effectively the reference way to do something. In the field of AI, for example, now it's very clear most of the people doing that are doing it on Ubuntu, and they all go faster as a result. There's just much less friction. And we accelerate that. We facilitate that. We make specific types of investments that essentially get rid of friction between the various groups that are competing and cooperating in AI. The same is true in robotics. The same is true in all kinds of fields that are important to people. Our view is that, you know, none of those folks are competing around the platform that they're using. And so they don't really mind if they end up sharing a platform. It's not, you know, if anything, it's reassuring to their customers. They don't want to be weird in that regard. So I guess the heart of that is there's a clear distinction between what people are selling and what we're selling. Right. And so that makes for a much more natural partnership. When folks on the other side of the table are conflicted about what they want to sell, then usually the conversation gets complicated. Our part in that, I think, also is to stay unconflicted. The temptation is to sort of get into everybody else's business. And we don't. I like partnering with smaller companies who are good at something and finding ways that the relationship between us effectively is healthy for them. I think it's really important when you are in a position to be an aggregator that you don't forget what it took to create the things that you're aggregating. And so, you know, I think we're unusually respectful of what it takes to be an innovator or an entrepreneur in open source. And that makes it certainly easier to partner.
Just switching gears a little bit to more ecosystem stuff. There's a lot of discussion in the community about how to define new open source licenses that prevent SaaS squatting, where a large SaaS company uses open source technology and either doesn't contribute or even undermines the company that's developing that software. When I interviewed Jay Kreps from Confluent, he mentioned that open source licenses were created at a time before large SaaS companies were using open source to sort of move into this infrastructure layer. Do you think the community needs to develop new open source licenses to mitigate this type of exploitation?
Well, you know, when it comes to rules and regulations and terms of engagement and so on, I think there's only one kind of perpetual rule, which is the old treat others the way you'd like to be treated, especially if the roles were reversed. And, you know, I think that's a universal story and has been the case for a long time. Beyond that, I'm not that much into sort of commandments written in stone. They don't tend to last. The world changes, dynamics change. And exploring, innovating, testing, finding new ways to organize, those are all normal. We have social norms and conventions, you know, ways to run society, ways to run businesses, regulatory frameworks and so on today that reflect our best understanding of what works. In that light, people exploring different approaches for licensing open source is normal. Remember, I'm focused on the whole spectrum of what's on GitHub. Our engagement with a bank, for example, is about helping them consume more of that diversity. So no one license is going to end up being the answer to all of the questions. You know, it's not like any of our users can be in a position where they say, look, we're only going to deal with stuff under GPLv2 or Apache this or BSD that, right? It just doesn't work that way. The question really is, how can we get the benefit of all of the open source out there? So we have to work well with all the people who are innovating, both in code, but also in licenses. So it doesn't work for me to be, you know, super ideological about the one license that's best for everybody. As I look at the current angst-ridden debate around open source licensing, I think there are three groups. There's the people producing open source, typically smaller, typically innovators, typically focused on creating something new. There are aggregators, call them the SaaS squatters. And then there are also the buyers. There are also the enterprises. And, you know, stepping back, I'd say, you know, we're only at the beginning of that debate. And so as a consequence, you know, what you're seeing is 1.0 type thinking from all of those players. There's shallow thinking in the arguments that I've seen from all sides. The cloud companies' arguments are a little bit like Marie Antoinette, you know, oh, let them eat cake. This should be fine. They just have a business model problem. You know what I mean? Like, shame. That belies the fact that they really do depend on innovators to innovate, and it isn't them. They do a lot of innovation, but it's not this kind of innovation. Conversely, the open source folks who are super upset at the idea that other people are making money off their stuff are missing, I think, some obvious points that they benefit from consumption and from engagement. They'd lose that if they weren't willing to make a trade of some form. And then you have the buyers, the people who ultimately pay the bills, who also, I think, they're a little behind the curve in terms of where the value is really coming from and how to engage with both those aggregator type players and the underlying innovators. And so, you know, I'm not particularly fussed about where we're at right now. I think it's normal for pendulums to swing. The pendulum has swung in one direction now. That's exercising people's minds. It's driving debate. I'm pretty sure it'll all work itself out.
Besides licensing, what are the biggest challenges facing companies that want to make an open source software distribution core to their business?
I think it's clear that open source on its own isn't enough. And I think that's because the sorts of things that people are trying to achieve with open source or the sorts of problems where people want to see open source play a role have mushroomed into, you know, the full spectrum of problems and opportunities that are out there. There was a time when interesting software could be written by one person or two people. That is still true. I mean, it's still kind of amazing how somebody will think of something and produce it. I love that, right? That sort of lone tinkerer, inventor, I love that. But that approach is completely not relevant when you're looking at producing something like Kubernetes, right? It's simply completely not relevant. There's no informal couple of people or one person that can do that. And I think a lot of the stress in the conversation comes from people who've had one experience of open source and therefore assume that they understand how it works or how it should work. And then they're applying that to circumstances where those ideas or approaches just flat out would not work. Compound that with the fact that, of course, people have interests. They're both either deliberately or somewhat naively blind to the things they might think that are really convenient truths, convenient because of their interests. There isn't going to be one approach that essentially enables open source to be relevant across the full spectrum of technology, because the full spectrum of technology is a very broad spectrum. And so people yelling at each other and saying, you don't understand, is probably mostly a symptom of the fact that people are coming from lots of different backgrounds and making naive assumptions about what it's like in the other person's shoes.
The raison d'etre of a for-profit company is to make money and to make a return for investors. But pure play open source software vendors also have a contract with the community. Is there a right way to balance these objectives?
I think it's important for people to understand what makes someone else tick. As soon as you start telling other people how they should behave, and specifically telling other people that they should behave the way that suits you or the way that you behave, you're probably missing the opportunity to get the benefit of having diverse perspectives. I think it's really important for people participating in a community to have some empathy for the people for whom the project is their lifeblood. That's super important. And often in the Ubuntu community, it's been valuable to remind people of the fact that we are a community because we have different interests and different needs, and figuring out how to make those things work is important. I tend to push back quite hard on the idea that the company must serve the community. I think it's important for both groups to understand mutual interests. I love that we make opportunity in Ubuntu for people who have completely different interests to Canonicals. There's an enormous amount of stuff that we do that they can free ride on effectively, which lets them explore interesting things that are important to them for whatever reason. It could be commercial, it could be personal, it could be scientific. You know, I'm happy to make that space. I push back pretty hard on anybody who says there shouldn't be space for Canonical. And I generally try to remind different groups inside the Ubuntu community of the fact that they can't expect everybody to act exactly the same way. Most often I see that sort of argument from people who have entirely external ways to support themselves. So very large companies that control access to enterprise accounts can make money using open source in those accounts effectively, but they certainly don't want anybody else coming into those accounts because their margins come from account control effectively. So a lot of the foundationitis that we see where you see large companies essentially standing up foundations is really predicated on the fact that while they want to benefit from true community participation and they want to benefit from innovators, they don't want to see either of those groups in their accounts. And they'd like to sort of create a fig leaf that is strictly non-commercial, that those accounts can't go and ask for certain things from. All of that's normal. We're in an evolving marketplace. I find just as a leader, it helps to remind people of the fact that the diversity of interests is what makes an interesting community.
Where do you see Canonical in 20 years?
20 years. That's super interesting. If I look back 15, it's been 15 years. In a sense, just an extraordinary amount has changed. You know, I wouldn't have predicted 15 years ago that we'd be a key platform on the mainframe and on the Raspberry Pi. I wouldn't have predicted the Raspberry Pi. And I think that's part of what I love about open source, is that people end up doing things with it that the creators of the open source didn't imagine. It's really hard to do that with proprietary software because sooner or later you'd run into something that is just a small little impediment, but you can't do anything about it. But some things really haven't changed. It is about enabling people to go faster with open source, to drive down the cost of open source, drive down the friction of open source. I don't see any other way of organizing software that seems poised to beat open source. And so I don't see anything on the horizon that looks like a discontinuity in that flow. Pretty certain that Canonical offers a better way to engage with the entirety of open source for a business. If you're a bank and you want to engage with open source, we're the next generation, we're the next wave. And we're already well up on the adoption curve. The early adopters are very comfortable with Ubuntu and Canonical, and it's now sort of we're on the fast rising part of the curve. Maybe there'll be some other organization that figures out a better way to do that. And that would be exciting. That would be interesting. But at the moment, I think we are well positioned to be the company that enables people to consume and integrate and operate open source across the full spectrum, across all the clouds and architectures and devices and things like that, better and more cost effectively. It's hard for me to predict what will happen at the application layer because I'm not an inventor of applications, right? I'm not competing with people who make databases or AI computer vision recognition systems or anything like that, right? There's an enormous amount of innovation that happens around us, which is kind of a privilege to watch, but I don't have to worry about guessing too much, you know, who's going to invent what there, because as long as they need a platform and as long as they want that platform on sort of reasonable and efficient commercial terms with a long-term commitment, there's a role for us to play.
Last question. Any advice for new entrepreneurs who are launching a business around open source software?
There's a real sort of double challenge in starting a tech operation that is open source. Starting a tech operation is always hard because you want to do something new, and that's surprisingly difficult. You know, like you genuinely have to do something different if you want to be successful, you know, from a technology point of view. And most of the people who would have that kind of open source view, there's a technology angle to it, right? There's something new that they want to do. And it's hard enough getting that right. With open source, you need to think about the fact that you're enabling your own competition is the blunt truth of it. You're enabling people to compete with you with the benefit of all the things that you've done. And that can be both financially and emotionally very daunting. But at the end of the day, I don't see any other model for software which is spreading as fast across all of the kind of categories of software out there today. If you're not going to be open source, you're almost certainly going to be niche. Now, that may be satisfying for you, but I doubt it. For most people, I think they want to define a category, and it really is going to be open source that will define a category. I'm not too worried about the non-open source work or the sort of wrapper around open source work that we see in the large aggregators, because in a sense, by definition, they're niche. They can only ever engage with people in their pond, maybe a big pond, but it's very clear where the boundaries are. For people who essentially want to have the whole world as an audience or a market, I think open source is an important component. It's very, very hard, but I do think it's the only way.
Mark Shuttleworth, cosmonaut, CEO, founder, Capetonian, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Special thanks to Claire from Canonical for helping us get on Mark's calendar. Transcription and episode audio can be found on opensourceunderdogs.com. Music from Broke for Free, Chris Zabriskie, and Lee Rosevier. Production assistance and transcription by Natalie Lau. Operational support from William Lau. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @FossPodcast. That's FOSS Podcast. Next week, we're heading back to Berlin, Germany to talk in person with Jacob Frund, founder and CEO of Komunda. Until then, thanks for listening.